Accession number 7310, rule number 9.
Tape 9. Colonel Cleve, could I ask you a little more about these very big railway guns, the 14-inch railway guns of the First World War? Boschbuster was obviously very successful, from what you have said. You did also say it was the only mobile battery gun. Is that right? Were the others not mobile?
The others were there were several other kinds of railway guns. 12-inch howitzers and a 9.2 Mark 13, but they were mobile in the sense that when you got them into position, the position they were due to fire from, there was a tremendous process of anchoring them to the ground by jacks and spades and all sorts of things, which took about 3 hours to get each gun into position. And in that sense, they were not mobile, because you couldn't up sticks and away quickly. On the other hand, Boschbuster, provided the railway line was surveyed beforehand and a little white arrow put on every degree of azimuth, the gun could be put into action, and sometimes we got it into action from several miles away within 5 minutes of arriving in the position. Off went the first round, because it was so railway mobile.
It was very interesting when you said that this was your little system, which you organised, unbeknown, really, to the generals above you.
They had no idea of it.
Is that so? Did you manage to keep this secret all through
the war? No, I wanted them to know, because my hope was that they would realise how mobile these guns were and use their mobility, but they never did. And that was entirely left in my own hands, and all that happened was that I was told to engage a certain target. And occasionally, General Alexander, VC, GOCRA First Army, was a splendid man. He really was very interested in the guns. And Lord Horne, fortunately, was the GOC First Army. And he took a great interest, being an ex-artilleryman, in the guns too. And they did understand them and my problems with the machinery when they developed. But I don't think anybody realised how extremely mobile these biggest guns that we've ever had in the army, how extremely mobile they were with regard to railway mobility. And it wasn't until the gun nearly got blown up 2 or 3 times that I realised what a valuable asset it was, and they made full use of it by firing first of all from one place, then on the same target from another, and on the same target again from a third place, all in the same night. Well, that was mobility, and I'd never succeeded in getting it across, either in World War I or in World War II.
So you were doing your little system. You were enacting that without permission from the generals. Am I right
without
in thinking
permission,
that?
Yes.
Yes.
In a sense, they were quite correct, because so long as I did my duty, which was to shell the target that they told me to shell, which was normally the enemy railway system, I think quite rightly they didn't interfere as to how I did it. So I took the law into my own hands and got the Royal Engineer Transport people to provide me with the locomotives I needed to move me all over the place, which is what I did within the area of Arras, where we were doing most of our shooting.
So you did have quite a degree of autonomy, really, didn't you, it would seem, of independence. They did leave
you
to get on
with it. I think so, yes. Fortunately, I think. I'm probably right in saying that some truth may be in the fact that generals knew so little about the gun that they left me to do the thing entirely on my own. Otherwise, with other guns, they knew much more about them and were very fussy about this, that and the other, but not with me. And after all, I was army troops. I came directly under First Army headquarters for operations. So no colonel, anybody less than the GOCRA could order me about. But they were responsible, the colonel, the Marine colonel, was responsible for the administration.
How about the scene shifter? Did you have much to do with scene shifter? As well as Boschbuster?
Oh, scene shifter, yes. No, very little to do with scene shifter because they were so valuable, these big guns. The scene shifter was separated from me from the moment we got into the fighting zone. And so I allocated Captain M.B. Elderton, who had been senior mathematical master at Sherbourne, to command the left section of a scene shifter, and he went to the area of Betun, under, also I think under First Army headquarters. Then later on, during the Fourth Army attack at Amiens, he was sent down there to shoot from there and got into an awful mess. And I had to go and see General GOCRA there, Blandford, I think it was, to get them out of it. In that, they, one night they were firing away from just outside Amiens, I think it was, and the gun went out of action, and they couldn't open the breech. And there's an awful hoo-ha about this. Just when they wanted to fire most, I had to go down and inquire what happened, and I found that they had all, none of the officers had taken any interest in what was going on, leaving their job, as they rightly should do, to the tiffies to see what was wrong with the breech mechanism. And when eventually, during the night, they did get it open, they found that somebody had left a spanner in the breech. And when the breech number had closed it, thinking to close it behind the shell, he jammed the spanner into the breech mechanism. I had to have take a court of inquiry to find out what happened. Fortunately, I got the officers exonerated. But it was rather bad luck on the tiffies getting into trouble because of it. So it couldn't fire for the rest of the battle. It was very trying. And scene shifter didn't do nearly as much shooting as we did. We seemed to be the pet of First Army, and we practically wore the gun out.
When you talk about the tiffies, who were these people? Were these the team?
No, the tiffies were the... we had two sergeant artificers with them who were responsible for keeping all the mechanics of the guns in action. The recoiling system and the recuperating system and all like that. And they were in constant attendance. In fact, the two tiffies were in attendance on Boschbusters in the main engine room. We had two engine rooms on board. And when the passing train set the camouflage on fire, and I remember they were awfully sensible. They banged the, the shutters back onto the engine to keep the fire away from the engine, jumped down clear of the thing themselves and got away with it. So they did very well. They were very on the spot. And what was more, as they were such new guns, and nobody knew anything about how they would behave in action or out of action for that much, Armstrong's agreed to provide one of their best mechanicians to go out with each gun. And we had... the less good of them, and the scene shifter had another chap, and they were put into uniform and given the rank of sergeant, and then they lived in the sergeant's mess. But they were very superior officials of from Vickers Armstrong's. So they made sure that everything was always in order. And they were very nice to have.
Could I ask you, with this business of the spanner in the works, as it was, with scene shifter, what actually happened to the Tiffies if they were responsible for that? Would they have been punished?
No, I don't think so on those occasions, because I think it was generally recognised that, especially at night time, when it was awfully difficult, we weren't allowed any lighting. In any case, we hadn't got any electric system on the guns. It was never dreamt that they would be required to fire at night. That I think there was generally a feeling, well, they did their best, and accidents happened in the best circles kind of thing. And I think when it was malicious, I think the powers that be had a very good sense of deciding whether the thing was malicious or accidental. In that case, it was a pure accident, and they recognised it as such. And I don't think anybody got into trouble.
Can you remember the approximate date when Boschbuster went into action?
I remember we arrived in France, I think, on May the 26th. Went straight to Boulogne because it was so wanted so much attention. It was quite unfinished when it left Armstrong's by mistake, and the AOC, it was then the Army Ordnance Corps, had to do a great deal of work on it to get it fit to go into action. And then we went into action about a week later. I think we must have got to the Garage de Repos, Savoy Berlet, early in June, and we had to continue the work on the valves, which were the responsible for most of the trouble, being spongy. And I think we didn't get really into action until the end of June, or may even have been the beginning of July. Then we went into action against the enemy railway system, Deschi-Liebecourt junctions, all important junctions like that. And then you might almost say that we were ready for serious action by the end of July, having had a little bit of experience and having thoroughly well surveyed all the railway lines that we might have fired from in that area. By survey, I mean marking every degree of azimuth with a little white arrow on the side of the railway line.
You mentioned earlier on that these big guns were connected with the breaking of the Hindenburg line.
Yes.
Could you explain the connection?
Well, the connection, I think, began with a request from the High Command in France for heavier guns than anything they had been left with at the end of the Somme, because they found that the Hindenburg line was such a monstrously fortified dugout system that nothing that we had then could penetrate the concrete, I suppose they were tops of the dugouts and things. And therefore it was then that they asked for something heavier to deal with it. But the curious thing is that instead of being putting, I think in a sense there was no particular need to waste the use of Boschbuster and Scene Shifter, which were the longest range guns we had in France at that time, on the shorter range targets such as the Hindenburg line, if they could cope with the guns they already had. That is why Boschbuster and Scene Shifter were nearly always firing at their maximum range, and nearly always on the enemy railway system, which idea was initiated, I think, by His Majesty King George V.
What was the maximum range of Boschbuster?
The maximum range of Boschbuster was 34,000 yards. I can't remember in miles, 22 miles, 20 miles or something, I think, about. And we were nearly always firing at that range. Very seldom. Once, on one occasion, we had to fire almost point blank. And we were rather terrified as to what would happen. But the gun behaved extremely well, and it didn't recoil too far along the railway line.
What exactly do you mean by that? You had to fire point blank. What was the danger?
Well, we were in action firing on a railway line when I suddenly had a phone call from Army headquarters to say that the infantry were being attacked in a very big way, all of a sudden. Like, could I possibly fire a round or two into the enemy who were doing the attack to help the infantry out? I said, yes, of course I can. And we fired a reduced charge, and at an elevation of about 8 degrees or something at the target. And I think that was the only occasion which we didn't shoot at the longest range we had. So we could shoot at anything, but then the gun wasn't very suited to that, because considering it was a very large shell, and it was fused in such a way that it depended on the impact of the shell being at rather a high angle to the ground to let the fuse go off, because the fuse would not go off on, shall we say, hitting infantry. So what happened to the shell, I have no idea.
Did you have any knowledge of what happened on the Hindenburg line? You know, you've explained the relationship of the big guns.
Well, the Hindenburg line was a very wonderful system, really. And I'm not in the least surprised that it held us up in those days. It extended, I'm not quite sure how far south, because that didn't concern us. But I do know it went in front of us, and it went over the Vimy Ridge, just slightly north of Arras. And the Vimy Ridge was a terrible place, because it was rather high up. It was on the main line from Arras to Lille or somewhere like that, I'm not sure. Main road, I mean. And you could see all over the country, both over the German country and over the British country, from the top of Vimy Ridge. It was so high and so clear of trees and things. And it was for that reason that it was decided to mine it. And the biggest mine of the war was blown up underneath the Hindenburg line, on the top of Vimy Ridge, on which occasion I can't remember. But that was when the main attack was on the Vimy Ridge, took place on the Vimy Ridge anyway. I remember the mine going up with a tremendous thing for those days, and made a crater about 40 or 50 feet across. I can't think what it was, it may be more. And that was supposed to have blown up the... We were very skilled at doing our mining, because both sides were trying to mine each other underneath the ground. And it was often a question of who got there first. And so the miners, we heard, could often hear the enemy miner, whichever side it was, doing their tapping because of the vibrations carrying underneath the ground. And if you heard intense cutting going on, getting more intense, you felt you were getting too near, I think. And I meant, I don't know what we did then. But that's all part of the game.
I think you mentioned earlier on that your Durham miners at one stage did some mining, did they not?
Oh, that was with 36 siege battery, the 8-inch battery.
Yes.
They were wonderful. They really were marvellous. And I'm quite amazed now at the number of references in my diaries in which I said that I which I hoped that I would not get promotion, or hoped I would not get to posted away from the battery, because I got so attached to those men. They were absolutely marvellous, all volunteers, Kitchener's volunteers. And what it meant to us was that the moment we got to the position on open ground, they were digging and digging and digging away, and within 24 hours we got, they had a dugout to each, they had dug a sloping shaft down to what would eventually become a dugout behind each gun. And that meant if things were getting too hot, they could go down to that shaft and feel fairly safe there. And as distinct from the German dugouts, which we occupied very thankfully when we captured German ground, our dugouts pointed towards the slope towards the enemy, whereas the enemy dugouts sloped towards us. So that was rather an uncomfortable feeling, because it meant that if a shell, a German shell, happened to strike the entrance of the dugout, it went right through to the bottom before it exploded, which was a pleasant thought. However, we're very thankful to have any dugout at all frequently. I think that was as much as I can remember about the Hindenburg line, which was always a fright to everybody, because nothing that we had could destroy the fortifications there. Whenever we tried to get across the Hindenburg line, all our attacks seemed to be repulsed.
What actually did it in the last resort, do you think, broke that line?
I'm not too sure about that, but I think it was sheer persistence, and I think we managed to outflank it by an advance, further south. For instance, the 4th Army attack at Amiens, which started on August the 8th, was, I think, south of the Hindenburg line. And I imagine when we got through there that we were able to turn the Hindenburg line without actually having to fight it yard by yard. That is as far as my memory goes. I may be wrong in some points there, but generally speaking, I think that is what happened.
What happened to the big guns at the end of the war? Was it a terrible job getting them back to Britain? Did they come back to Britain that
time? Oh, yes. Not really, because Bosch Buster was such a remarkable gun and so unfinished in that it had never had its range and accuracy trials from which the range tables should have been made. And so, at my suggestion, Bosch Buster was sent home very soon after the armistice to continue the range and accuracy trials for the 14-inch gun on a railway mounting. And that went alone ahead of all the other guns and equipment that was being sent home. And scene shifter, I was left with scene shifter till June 1919, because that was considered in a low order priority to get home, and lots of the other guns were sent home first. But eventually they were both got back to England.
What happened to them then?
Well, that's a mystery. I quite lost touch with them, completely lost touch with them. I never saw or heard of them again, except on one occasion, which I completely forgot about until World War II, but perhaps I should mention that later on. But they disappeared, put it that way, and at the disarmament conference, it was decided between Germany and ourselves and America and all the others that all super heavy railway guns were to be destroyed. All the super-heavy artillery were to be destroyed. So we come now to June or July 1919, when I found myself left alone with Major J.J. Llewellyn, who later on became Lord Llewellyn. He and I were at Duncumye, he with his 12-inch Mark I howitzer, railway howitzer, called Alpha, and which he eventually had mounted near Poole, but then just brought into action again for World War II. And I was left with scene shifter and the officer's mess wagon. And he had his officer's mess wagon, and we became great friends then, with all the others having been demobilized except us. Then came the day when I had to part with scene shifter and took it down to Calais and saw it loaded safely onto the Richborough ferry. After that, I quite lost touch with it. What they did with it, I have no idea to this day. It just disappeared, along with Bosch Buster. And that was the end of World War I. And after that came all the between war thing, and no thought of railway guns or anything about World War I ever occurred again. It was taboo to mention anything about World War I. It was such an unpopular thing at that time. I remember it so well.